With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. A quarantine has been ordered in Los Angeles County after the Tao fruit fly was discovered. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has placed a portion of Los Angeles County under quarantine for the Tao fruit fly following detection of more than 20 flies in the unincorporated area of Stevenson Ranch near the city of Santa Clarita. The fly is native to Asia and is a serious threat to agriculture and natural resources, with a very wide host range including numerous fruits and vegetables and a select range of native plants here in California. The CDFA asked residents living in the quarantined area not to move any fruit flies or vegetables from their property. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Farm Bureau is encouraging farmers to connect with their lawmakers during this August recess. Lawmakers from the House and Senate are on the annual August recess back in their respective districts and states. Tom Donnelly, American Farm Bureau Federation Director of Grassroots Program Development, says lawmakers will spend that time hearing from voters.
So it's a great time for farmers and ranchers to meet with and communicate with lawmakers. This year is especially important since Congress is working to reauthorize the Farm Bill. And we've been encouraging our members and all farmers and ranchers to make sure that they take advantage of the August recess and discuss the merits of the Farm Bill, how it has helped them over the last 5 years, and what changes would make it better going forward.
He says forming a relationship with lawmakers can set farmers or ranchers up to be a resource for those elected officials well into the future.
And when they get active, when they engage on a legislative or regulatory issue, their voices are heard. That's the importance of grassroots advocacy, to get out there, meet with your lawmakers, tell them what's going on in your town, in your district, in your county, at your farm, at your ranch, and make sure that they hear the agriculture voice.
And now here's Brian German with more Ag News.
Several economic influences are combining to put pressure on farmers. Senior analyst covering fruits and tree nuts for Rabo Agri Finance, David Magana, described the factors that farmers are having to navigate.
If we think about the macro economy, we see that inflation has been persistent. Just 18 months ago, we had that question if inflation was going to be transitionary or not. Now we know the answer. And definitely in response to that, monetary policy, particularly increases in interest rate, has been higher than expected by most. So that is putting some pressure on borrowing money, definitely becoming more of a challenge for growers and consumers as well. But on a positive note, we've seen that some supply side factors have been moving in the right direction.
Good news for watermelons after some early season challenges. VP of Crops and Soils at Van Groningen & Sons Incorporated, Brian Van Groningen, said they lost about 3 weeks of their normal season due to weather, but prices now are helping to mitigate those setbacks.
At this point, the fields are producing pretty well, but I'd say our early planted fields, maybe our first third of our acres, are probably the yields are off by probably 15 to 20%. So it's kind of been a rough, you know, as far as yield goes, just losing those extra weeks plus the early fields being less productive. Fortunately, the market price right now is good. I'd say we're seeing about a 20% maybe price bump. So those things are close to equaling each other out at this point. But it'll be hard to say as we move forward. But generally speaking, the price and the demand and the pricing has been very good. Usually by this time, things start to kind of, there's a lot of supply in not only Bakersfield, but Central Valley in this area. And even further north of us, there's a lot of production that comes in at the same time. And that usually kind of brings the supply up and the demand starts to waver a little, but we haven't seen that yet. So we'll see how the month of August goes.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, ranking member of the Senate Agriculture Committee, John Bozeman of Arkansas, traveled far north Monday for a Farm Bill roundtable in Fargo, North Dakota. He, along with Senators Kevin Cramer and John Hoeven, and North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner Doug Goring, listened to the concerns and comments from the agriculture industry leaders. I spoke with the four of them at the conclusion. Commissioner Goring mentioned during the roundtable about the importance of remembering specialty crops in the Farm Bill. I asked him about that after.
Well, first of all, there's probably about 14 crops out of those 54 that if it wasn't for specialty crop block grants, we couldn't have research. We couldn't have some ability to tweak marketing and to make to create better access to the consumers, our domestic and international. Keep in mind, specialty crop came from Congress. It didn't come from USDA. And in fact, within the federal government, they kind of fought it and pushed back on it right away. But Congress pretty much stood their ground, said, no, we need to do this. And we use it now to help the pulse crops, dry bean production, peas, lentils, potatoes, sunflowers. If you didn't have that money, you couldn't do the research. You couldn't do what we need to do to support their efforts to produce in a marketplace where they pretty much are overshadowed.
During the roundtable, Senator Bozeman talked about keeping conservation programs voluntary. I asked him to expand on his views.
What needs to be included or excluded in the Farm Bill, and that is a red line for me. We simply are not going to get ourselves in a situation where we have a Farm Bill that makes it such that you have to be climate friendly enough to participate in the risk management tools, conservation friendly enough. So these need to be voluntary, and that's, again, is so very important. So I want to assure your listeners that if I have anything to do with it, I simply can't support a Farm Bill that goes down that path. We've seen what happens when you do that in the Netherlands and Germany. And the thing, the places where it really wreaks the most havoc are with the small producers. The big boys are going to be able to, they'll come up with the regulatory atmosphere that they need to. You know, they'll hire the people they need to keep track of all this. It's the small producers, which we desperately are trying to help, again, to make viable rural America. They're the ones that will really struggle and not, simply not doing, be able to do it because of the regulatory atmosphere that they'll have going forward with something like that. And then Washington is notorious for a one-size-fits-all. So the one thing I've learned traveling throughout the country, the way that we have is that it's very, very different in North Dakota. In fact, it's very, very different in some parts of North Dakota compared to other parts, some farms compared to another part of the farm. So you have to be able to have the ability to, you know, to react to those kind of things and you know, some sort of mandatory program that is ties your climate friendliness to the safety nets or conservation, we simply aren't going to do.
When asked about the timeline for the new Farm Bill, Bozeman said he does not expect it to be done by the time the current bill expires in September, but he does think it could be done by the end of this year.
I feel very strongly, I think Senator Sabinow feels strongly, that we'd like to get this thing done by the first of the year. And it's interesting, we don't have to do a lot of things if, you know, with it running out October 1st, it's not like we have to do a lot of things to continue on. USDA is telling us they've got the money to continue on till the 1st of January.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's Livestock Report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the two main sponsors of the cattle marketing reform legislation are now split over whether to try and include the measure in the Farm Bill. Senator Chuck Grassley says his chief co-sponsor of the Cattle Price Discovery and Transparency Act now wants to take a different path.
Senator Fisher, one of our main leaders in this area, has told the leadership of the committee that she doesn't want it included in the Farm Bill. So with her saying that, it's pretty difficult for us to move ahead for it.
Now, Fisher's office did not respond for comment in time for this story, but Grassley says he could still bring up the measure during the Farm Bill debate, as enough ag senators support the bill to help independent producers through regional negotiated pricing. And Grassley's counting on Montana Democrat John Tester pressing Majority Leader Chuck Schumer for floor time on a freestanding bill.
He needs that legislation to get reelected, and I would think Schumer would want to do all he could to help Tester get reelected, because it's very much a Republican state.
Now, as for the Senate Ag Committee moving a farm bill?
I think it probably will be early October. I haven't seen enough movement yet to say that it could be done in September.
House Ag Chair G.T. Thompson plans to move his farm bill through the committee next month, though appropriations fights could eat up floor time needed for a farm bill in September when the current farm law expires. And last week, the American Sheep Industry Association's executive board held its summer meeting in Idaho Falls, Idaho. The primary goal was to approve the association budget that will now go before the full ASI board of directors for final approval. Members of the board will receive voting information and instructions by email sometime yet this week. But while in Idaho, the executive board met with leaders of the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station, which ASI successfully fought to remove from a federal closure list. A group of ASI's young entrepreneurs taking part in a summer tour of eastern Idaho joined the executive board during its time at the station. In addition to lobbying congressional leaders to save the station from closure, ASI supported the hiring of additional research personnel at the station, as well as more than $4 million in infrastructure improvements to the actual facility. As part of that meeting, station personnel demonstrated lambing and handling procedures that are common throughout the Intermountain West. Now, there was also some discussion and collaborative work with the Animal Disease Research Unit in Pullman, Washington, which has resulted in identification of genomic regions associated with sheep nasal shedding. A lot of genomic information has been gathered, which they're using to discover markers associated with positive economic and ecological outcomes of sheep production. By the end of the project, they will have collected genotype and phenotype information from more than 2,400 sheep of various breeds. Already about 75% of the data has been collected, and the remaining data is expected to be collected by 2024. Read more about this on the ASI website, sheepusa.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Economic headwinds are not stopping farmland growth. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The value of U.S. farmland continues to grow despite economic headwinds. USDA economist Sean Arita says this year's growth in farmland values is stronger than some had expected.
It's still very, very strong growth. This is up again, 7.4%. And I think moving into this, you know, there had been a lot of concern, again, with rising interest rates. The Fed, you know, had ramped it up at a very unprecedented level of acceleration to combat inflation. There had been talk about possible recession and commodity prices have been easing. Input prices are still elevated. So we thought, you know, I think many of us were thinking, well, for the farmland values, that maybe this had would lead to some softening. But, you know, the 7.4% on top of the 12.4% we had last year, that's still very, very strong.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Legislation was enacted late in 2022 that impacted retirement plans. The bugs are still being worked out, but the IRS recently granted relief to those that thought they would have to take a required minimum distribution in 2023 and to those that inherited an IRA. A law enacted late in 2022 raised the age at which required minimum distributions from an IRA or pension plan must start to April 1 of the year after which a beneficiary turns age 73 instead of April 1 of the year after which the beneficiary turns age 72. By the time the law was enacted, financial institutions had already issued RMD notices to IRA owners that turned 72 in 2022. These persons were led to believe that they needed to take a distribution by April 1 of 2023. But under the new law, no distribution was required in 2023. The IRS has now said that these persons have until September 30 to return the distributed funds to their accounts to avoid having the distribution be taxable. The IRS also granted relief to persons that inherited an IRA that are required to withdraw all the funds within 10 years of the account owner's death. Under the IRS relief, these beneficiaries are not required to take the RMD in 2023. This is good news for farmers and others that are impacted. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Most all segments of agriculture and agribusiness understand that there is an explosion of big data taking place. Yet the question becomes,
how do you manage this data such that the communities that are affected by the data can benefit from the data and not just be victims of other people using this data who have the capacity?
The answer, according to Sumer Johal of the AgStack Foundation, is building on and upon a foundation of open source data and applications.
That eventually open source communities, when they come together, can actually do better in terms of building infrastructure to manage this data instead of just proprietary application silos.
This led to the formation of the AgStack Foundation, a collaboration of the Lydex Foundation, IBM, Clemson University, and other partners to develop an easy, accessible infrastructure system to search for big data in the ag spectrum.
Applications can be developed much cheaper and faster, so time to market and cost to market advantages are abound in the private sector.
In addition, this would create interoperability among applications. In other words, the ability of farm-based big data apps to talk to each other, whether the source or program is private or public-based. For instance,
equipment data from tractors and equipment for combines and such. There's also a lot of data besides that from different government agencies that is published. There's a whole bunch of data being published about from satellites that are public. There are weather systems that are entire country data is being published. So there's a lot of public data that is being published. And then there's a lot of private data that is connectable.
So think of such a system being plug and play. One example is
equipment like a tractor could communicate with a sensor on the field, like a moisture sensor, without having to build proprietary software to do so, as long as both of them had connectors for that particular open source software, which being free is easy to do.
Another is an AgStack Foundation Clemson University collaboration called AgREC, a big data hub for cooperative extension information on agronomy and other topics.
We're enabling that sharing to happen much more efficiently. People can search and find what they're looking for. They can filter based on certain criteria. Without such an information hub, accessing this information becomes really difficult, even though it's available.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do you listen?
I typically listen here at work from my desk on my way to work in the morning. When we wake up, it goes on the radio.
I can hear a song and be instantly transported back to a time in my life that I enjoy remembering.
I think that's what I like listening to radio for, is just to stay informed on whether it's news, sports, new music, anything.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Well, that conveyor belt of rain events, as we've called them, continues in key areas, and that could lead to some surprises in Friday's USDA crop report. I'm Mark Oppold with today's bottom line report brought to you by Helena. The weekly crop condition update overnight gives credence to those who suggest USDA will at least leave corn and soybean yields unchanged Friday morning. Some analysts, though, suggesting a slight increase from July, something few thought possible 30 days ago. Ukraine continues Black Sea area bombing raids on Russian oil tankers, but even that news and a weaker dollar has failed to support futures here early week. December corn, next stop down, 478 to 480 in our view. November soybeans, longer term, could be falling to right near $12 the next 2.5 to 3 weeks. That pro-farmer crop tour the week of the 21st looms larger than ever. This is the Bottom Line Report. Manage your in-season nutrition with flexible applications of products like Coron Metra from Helena. Visit helenaagra.com to learn more. Kansas, Nebraska, and Western Iowa cattle feedlots reporting more heat-related deaths in July than previously thought. October cattle make another run back toward contract highs. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
What's going on in the wheat market? It's been an up-and-down run in the wheat market in recent months. Kim Anderson, a grain market economist with Oklahoma State University Extension, talks about the latest in the wheat market.
Well, if you look on what's going on with prices, we've had quite a dip. You go back to June 1, we was running around $7.50, wallered around plus or minus 60 cents or so until we got to mid-July, and then we had that report. Exports in Russia had plenty of wheat production on the market. Then they were going to stop the exports out of Ukraine. We got an increase up to $8.50. We've now taken about $1.40 off of that.
Anderson says it's important to keep an eye on what's going on with Ukraine's wheat.
I think it's important that we watch what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. I think right now what they're saying is that we're going to get that wheat out of there. I think you need to remember that we're expected to harvest a 29.3 billion bushel world crop. That's a record.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. My recipe today is a grilled stone fruit berry compote. Such incredible flavors right now. Stone fruits, as we know, are available until the end of September, and that's usually when I stop using them on my menus, only because they're not as good. But right now, they are blooming, they are incredible, and I promise these recipes are not going to disappoint. Let's get untamed. So the very first step is to take our nectarines. I'm going to use two nectarines, and remember, I only have four people in my family, so if you got more, you want to make a little bit more, because everybody's going to want at least a couple of these different variations of stone fruit. We take the two nectarines, and we're going to slice them, and I don't want to slice them small just yet. I want to have them cut into four. So I take that nectarine and I cut off each side. I'm going to put that onto a hot grill. And now I want the grill to be a cast iron hot grill. That's preferably what I'm using, just one that you put over your stovetop. I'm going to have that at a medium high heat. If it's too high, it's just going to start making a mess. So medium high is perfect for this, and let it sit for about 5 minutes with the heat on it before you start putting anything on the grill. I'm going to very easily just coat some oil over the top of that. And I'm going to put my nectarines and my plums onto the grill. Remember, our nectarines and plums, we're going to cut into fours. It's very, very important. Our Black Mission figs are not going to be grilled. We're going to just have the Black Mission figs the way they're supposed to be. I'm just going to slice them thin, and we're going to have those ready to go, because the fig, we don't want to cook it. Once we start cooking the fig, the natural flavor is going to start to come out of it, and it's going to be pretty much ruined. That figgy deliciousness that we want has to just stay in there, and the best way to have that is fresh. Salt and pepper over the top of this. And in a bain-marie, which is a double boiler, I'm going to take 1 cup of berries, raspberries, blackberries, and 1 cup of sugar, and I'm going to reduce that down over the top. And the natural juices from those fruits are going to start to come out. I'm also going to have some blueberries. If you could get blueberries, have at it, please, because it's going to make it just so much better. But we want that berry flavor, and then we want that grilled stone fruit flavor with that gorgonzola. It makes for something very beautiful if you put it over a little crostini. But once we have our fruit inside of the bain-marie, I'm just going to use a spatula, move that around carefully so we can ensure that we don't damage the fruit, but we just want to help to enhance the flavor of that fruit. I'm going to take my grilled fruits. I'm going to cut them as small as I can. As uniform as possible is always important. And we're going to put that on the top of our crostini. Next, I'm going to put the compote over the top of that. And then I'm going to shave the gorgonzola over the top of that. The best way to get the gorgonzola to where you can shave it with a microplane is to freeze it or drop it in liquid nitrogen. I promise it will not disappoint. For this and many more of my Untamed recipes, tips, tricks, and all things Untamed, go to my website, www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez. You all know me as the Untamed Chef from Agriculture.
You may be familiar with efforts to create greater water efficiency and use in agriculture via management strategies and conservation methods in crops. Some that come to mind include drought-tolerant plant varieties and more efficient irrigation methods. Yet water use efficiency is also being studied within the livestock sector.
We really need to be focusing on it because we have a growing population and we need to be able to feed that population. But at the same time, our freshwater resources are kind of diminishing. So in order to do that, we need to focus on the water sustainability aspect and focus on water efficiency related traits in livestock production.
Specifically in the case of University of Arkansas researcher Sarah Orlowski, poultry.
So are we going to impact feed conversion? Are we going to impact body weight? What other efficiency-related traits could be negatively or positively impacted by selection for water efficiency?
So Orlowski and colleagues from other institutions are developing technologies to measure water intake on an individual bird basis. Not only that, they are also studying how breeding for water efficiency traits in poultry might impact other traits.
And we hope that with our selection program that we have going on now, other primary breeder companies will be able to kind of implement this selection into their programs and maybe even extends out into other livestock species, whether it be cattle or pigs.
The research is currently in the fourth generation of two types of genetic selection, one group of poultry with traits for greater water efficiency, the other with less water efficiency traits.
But now we have the data and we have the technology for primary breeder companies to kind of implement that into their selection programs in hopes of them creating more water efficient lines that will then in turn feed the world. So we're more just a pilot study to see what happens when we select for water efficiency.
The research is supported in part by a USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture grant. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have another episode of the Farm Side Chat. It's American Farm Bureau's podcast where this week President Zippy Duval talks all about grazing on public lands and why it matters.
His name's Ben Mingus. Welcome to the show, Ben, and tell us a little bit about your ranch and yourself and about what part of the state that is in. Are you close to the border or not?
We're north of the border. Everyone's north of the border, but we're north of the I-10. So we don't get the border traffic that a lot of my neighbors do that are further south. But yeah, we're between Safford and Morenci, Arizona, and those are two large copper mining communities, and so we border the largest copper mine in North America, and so we're mostly on BLM land. We have a small amount of private, but BLM is Bureau of Land Management land, and 83% of Arizona is federal land. And so most ranchers in the state have some amount of, of federal land, and so we're no exception. So yeah, we're about 2 hours east of Tucson.
So I want you to repeat that, because I don't think a lot of people understand it. 83% of the state of Arizona is either BLM or it's federal government land.
Right.
That doesn't leave a whole lot left for someone to own and farm on. So you depend on these acres of BLM to be able to ranch.
Right. Yeah. We're the county that I was raised in, it's 9% is privately owned. So we're state 48 out here. So I think at the time Arizona was created, the federal government was already taking control. And so maybe that's why we have so much federal land. But the majority of ranchers depend on the federal government for their leases. We really have no other option but to have federal lands if you want to be serious in the cow business in Arizona.
Yeah. So you talked about leases. The difference between your region of the world and my region is just about everyone here owns their land. I operate on about 1,500 acres here, and that's probably small to you because it takes so many acres per cow out there. I can put almost a cow and a half to the acre here. What's your head count?
So we could put a cow on about 60 acres.
Yeah, so that's a big difference. So your need for land is a lot heavier than my need for land. So, and you know, we do the same thing, but it's just really totally different ways of doing the same thing. So tell us a little bit how dependent farmers, ranchers are on those leases. Tell us a little bit about the leases and the ranch that you're on.
Well, I often hear the talking point of ranchers pay greatly reduced lease rates for these grazing allotments. And yes, that's true, but we paid for that right. So I don't know what an apartment would rent for in Washington, D.C., but I don't know, maybe $2,000 a month. Is that in the ballpark?
You're about two-thirds there. That's about where you're at.
Oh, really? So let's say maybe $3,000 a month. Well, instead of paying $3,000 a month, you pay $1 million for that apartment, and you have the right to lease it for $300 a month. And so, you know, these allotments aren't something that you just sign up for. They're things that you have to buy. And so we buy the allotment, and then we still pay a lease rate. And yes, that is a reduced lease rate, but there's not many places not many places east of the Mississippi where you buy the land, but then you lease it after you buy it.
As a young rancher, I don't know whether it seemed possible to be able to go out and purchase a lease right and then turn around and lease it out each year. If you did, I'm assuming that would just be almost the same as in my area. You'd have to go out and find a piece of land, borrow the money to buy that land, and then end up paying taxes on it for the rest of your life. Would you say that's about the same thing? You're buying that lease and instead of purchasing the land itself?
Yeah, that would be a similar example on privately owned land.
So how long will a lease go, and is it auctioned off or is it bidded off, or how does that, I mean, because obviously you have to make investments in land to ranch it. How long can you have that land and be able to make investments on it?
Well, we could have that land as long, we can hand it down to generations. The grazing allotments can be handed down, but they could also be sold. In Arizona, they estimate it's about 60 allotments are for sale at any given time. There's also permit renewals. On the federal government land, there is what's called National Environmental Policy Act, and they have the ability to re-up your permit every 10 years. And so that's what they're supposed to do, is to give you a permit renewal every 10 years, and they'll do a study on whether or not, you know, cattle are affecting certain species or what amount of cattle should be out there on the land. You know, that's one of the other points that I wanted to bring up, is that all of the environmentally just things that have been identified as sound practices in the livestock industry, all of those things are mandated on federal lands. So rest rotational grazing is a mandate on a U.S. Forest Service land. On my ranch, we have a lot of erosion control. There's stocking rates that are mandated on each allotment. And so those are the practices that are often purported by government. And so we've been able to implement them, the majority of them, on my ranch.
So those practices considered sustainability practices, sustainable practices.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah. So that word sustainability is a buzzword just about all over the country, but especially in Washington, D.C. Outside of those things, what else are you doing on your ranch as far as sustainability?
Well, we have 60 to 100 acres per cow, so we have a lot of space per cow, and I think of that as sustainable. All of the water that is pumped on the ranch is done so with solar power. You know, cows don't use that much water compared to humans. There's a lake in Phoenix called Tempe Town Lake, and I measured the evaporation of that lake. In 3 days, more evaporates out of that lake than my cows drink in a year. So that's going into the air, being wasted. And these cows are producing, you know, calves that provide around 500 pounds of meat to American families for each calf. So, you know, that's a sustainable practice in terms of water. One of the things that I think I've spoken to you about before, Zippy, is the amount of carbon sequestration that is out there is actually something that we lack quite a bit of data on. When you're talking about 60 to 100 acres of vegetation per cow, each tree sequesters a certain amount of carbon, and cows are often blamed for the spread of those trees. All across the West, they treat mesquite, and they blame the cow for the spread of mesquite because the cows eat the seeds eat the beans, and they germinate the seeds and they spread mesquite. Well, each one of those mesquite trees on average sequesters about 50 pounds of carbon. So you need 150 trees to offset one cow, somewhere in there. Well, I have over 300 mesquite trees per cow on the ranch. So, you know, I think that would be the term carbon positive. And so yep. I have a carbon positive operation. And so I would think that would fall under the sustainability definition.
That was just a portion of their conversation. To listen to the full episode, visit fb.org. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the short break.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for. Harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet. Or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. IDFA recognizes dairy businesses for worker safety. The International Dairy Food Association is recognizing 25 dairy businesses for their efforts in workplace safety with its IDFA Dairy Industry Safety Recognition Award. This is the 20th year IDFA has been awarding these businesses for their hard work. Michael Dykes, IDFA president and CEO, says, quote, "The dairy industry continues to demonstrate that the safety of our people and our food is the dairy industry's number one priority." Adding, quote, "Each safety recognition award represents the success of the innovative and proactive approaches to workplace safety by dairy company safety teams. Consumers and customers of dairy food companies value how these innovations help to deliver safe, nutritious food to people around the world. IDFA awarded 23 Outstanding Facility Safety Awards, and they recognize two companies as the most improved facilities. West Coast mentions include Kroger Riverside in Riverside, California, Nelson Jameson of Turlock, California, and Kroger Tolson Dairy of Tolson, Arizona. To view a full list of the winners, visit IDFA.org.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has unveiled a new grant program aimed at strengthening and enhancing the production and marketing of sheep and sheep products across the nation. The Sheep Production and Marketing Grant Program will make available a total of $300,000 in funding, offering a valuable opportunity for industry members to enhance their operations. Those interested in the opportunity are encouraged to submit a grant application before the September 15th deadline. USDA Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs Ginny Lester Moffitt emphasized the positive impact that previous initiatives supported by the program have had on the country's sheep industry. The projects have achieved notable results ranging from augmenting processing capacity in areas facing production bottlenecks to conducting vital research on diseases affecting sheep flocks. Applications must be submitted directly to the National Sheep Industry Improvement Center, who will then make funding recommendations to AMS for approval. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.